Get a head start on 2025 with CNBC's Big January, the hottest tech event, CES, from Las Vegas. The data, the numbers, the jobs report, and meet the future of biotech and pharma at JPM Healthcare. Check out the Amex Golf Tournament from California, Inauguration Day, and the meeting of world leaders in Davos. Plus, the first Fed decision of the year. Get ahead of the game. Listen to CNBC on the Odyssey app.
All right, Payne and Pendergast, it's 9 o'clock on a Tuesday. That means the power rankings are out. And as we do every Tuesday at 9 o'clock, we check in and see where the experts think the Texans are, and we do that by ranking the experts. We power rank the power rankings at 9 a.m. There's four of them we use for this exercise, in no particular order yet. ESPN.com, TheAthletic.com, CBSSports.com, and SI.com, Sports Illustrated. So let's do this here. We power rank the power rankings, starting with number four, The Athletic, which Seth has the Texans at number 15. This is about as low as the Texans have been on people's power rankings all season long. They've spent the entire season, for the most part, hovering at worst like around 12 or 13 till the last couple weeks. They've gotten as high as 3 or 4 when they were 6-2 earlier this year. I think both you and I thought it might have been a little bit of fool's gold at that point, just based on how...
I mean, they were playing like a 500 football team, no matter what their record was over the course of the first half of the season.
Yeah.
You know, the point differential would show you that. They had scored about the exact same number of points as they'd had scored against them. I think the fact that some of these places love the advanced stats, and like the Texans look better on some of the advanced stats than they actually are in reality, including on defense. I think they're overrated defensively in some ways. As much as it feels like, oh, the Texans suck, like, no, they're a 500 football team. They play and compete like a 500 football team. They lose to some bad teams. They beat other mediocre and bad teams. They've only beat one good team all year long, and then they've lost to other good teams. So just this last week notwithstanding, it's been like a 500 football team the entire year.
And in that division, that's good enough to clinch the division with 3 weeks left in the season. You know, that's just how it is. The category for The Athletic, by the way, the Texans were 13th last week, so the loss to the Ravens pushed them down two spots with The Athletic. The category they do in terms of the topic for each team is what's next. And I don't know if it means what's next after the season or what's next this week or whatever, but for the Texans, I think this applies regardless of whether next means today or in a month. Self-scouting for the offensive coaching staff. Mm-hmm. Offensive coordinator Bobby Slowik did so well in 2023 that he got head coaching interviews in the offseason. He might get fired this offseason. Houston has dropped from 12th in yards per play and 15th in EPA, expected points added per play, to 24th and 25th this season. And I just, if I stop right there, there was a period earlier this season where a lot of the stats for the Texans were they've been this bad over the last 4 weeks, or they've been this bad. The last 2 months have dragged this offense down so drastically. This is where they are for the year. They're they are a bottom quartile offense by, in my mind, two of the most important, if not the two most important metrics that measure offensive play other than scoring points, because I know that's what you're going to say. But yards per play and EPA per play are big efficiency measurements, I think, and they're horrible at both of those things right now.
Yeah, especially when it comes to how routinely can you successfully run the football.
Yes.
Very, very rarely is that the case. It's great when they do it well, because Joe Mixon ends up with huge yardage. I got annoyed at somebody on X the other day because he did the thing which I hate most, which is he tried to use an argument based on something I never said, which is he said, well, so Bobby wasn't an issue before, but now he's an issue this year. That's not what I heard in the offseason. Like, no. What I said the entire offseason was Bobby Slowik was promising he's got to show that he can actually establish a respectable rushing attack, not even a league-leading rushing attack, but he's not a proven commodity as an offensive coordinator. That was the big question. And in that regard, he still has very much not proven that. And then on the other side, just in the passing game and with everything else, offensive coordinators are just like quarterbacks. it's once they start to get, once the league has film on you and they start to get to know your tendencies and your strengths and weaknesses, it's harder in the second year. Yeah. And like so far, it's, you could argue about how much Bobby Slowik is to blame or not, but there's no way you can argue that he hasn't proven anything positive this year.
Right.
You can make excuses for him, but there's, you got to concede that he hasn't shown anything positive, or to just show that he's built on the promise that he had last year.
Well, he doesn't even have good answers when you ask him what they do well. Like he said, explosives, and I'm like, okay, well, where are all
the explosives have largely been Nico or Joe Mixon being a superhero.
Yes.
Like I said that a few weeks ago, it feels like a, feels like a bad high school team that has a couple of future pro football players.
Yeah, that's what it is.
You know, like it's enough that they just win with those guys, but they're doing nothing else offensively.
Offensively,
to really
help. You're absolutely right. Yeah. All right, number three, power ranking of the power rankings, SI.com, which also has the Texans at 15th, down four from number 11 last week. So the Baltimore Ravens, the loss to the Ravens, at this juncture in the year, you fall four spots. That's a pretty big dip. And Connor Orr says this about the Texans, Seth. All of the biomarkers in a massive loss to the Ravens in which the offense was shut out were troubling. C.J. Stroud again looked frozen against split safety looks. The defense was stomped out by Derrick Henry. Houston's not alone there. And that's Connor Orr saying that, not me. And Lamar Jackson was allowed to spend more time from snap to throw than at any point this season with no punishment. That's pretty damning. Barring a major identity shift, the Texans are looking like a prime candidate to get boat raced just as their playoff journey begins.
Yeah. As far as what he's talking about, CJ reacting to shell coverages and all of that, it was watching the Bengals and the Texans in that same several-day window. Man, Joe Burrow was just thrashing the Broncos over the middle, in the soft spots, in zone. It was really interesting because the one starting cornerback there for the Broncos has kind of been he's had health issues. And when they had to play zone and when he was out of the game, man, Burrow just thrashed him. So I'm watching, I'm thinking, all right, boy, he's pulling the trigger really fast. But also, you got to concede that, man, he's also throwing to wide receivers that have been with him for a long time. And it's a more balanced offense. There's more. Oh, yeah. The linebackers were actually biting on the play action. Where with the Texans, they just don't bother. No. The linebackers just kind of sit back and they're like, I'll come up and make a tackle when it's
right,
time.
Right, right.
Yeah, like what am I worried about these guys? No.
Yep. All right. Number two, power ranking of the power rankings, CBSSports.com. That would be Pete Prisco. The Texans are 14th, holding steady at number 14 on CBSSports.com. Here's what Pete Prisco says. He's always very brief. They got rocked by the Ravens on Christmas Day and seem to be limping into the playoffs. They are locked in as the fourth seed, but they don't look like one. Actually, they do. The fourth seed is typically the worst of the four division winners. They look like that.
Yeah, what are you talking about, Prisco? Exactly. Every year there's a couple of four seeds that you're like, oh, they should be the seventh seed.
Right. Right. Yeah. No, they look exactly like a four seed, Mackie, I tell you. So 14th on CBSSports.com.
I think also, though, too, like, yeah, okay, they don't look like they should be a four seed, but the other than the AFC North winner, whoever the sixth and seventh seed, like they've got their blemishes and flaws.
Sure.
Too. So it's not, I don't think it's not as big an insult as Prisco, I think, is kind of presenting it.
Are the Texans favored at home against the Steelers or the Chargers, do you think? Like, will they be a favorite at NRG? Against the Steelers, as you and I have pointed out several times, they might not even be the home team.
I think they'll be favored at home because of how the defense has played versus those two. Like, you know, the Chargers have had some lulls offensively. And really, it's just the last couple of weeks that they got it going again offensively. And then, like, Russell Wilson has looked like the best version of Russell Wilson and the worst version of Russell Wilson at times this season. So I think the Texans will be favored in both those games. And it'll be a surprise to a lot of people locally because it feels like they shouldn't be favored to anybody. But the way they build the lines and everything, I'll be surprised if they're not favorites.
I'll be surprised if they're not favorites. I'll be shocked if they're more than a field goal favorite.
Yeah, it'll be, they'll need that home field advantage, yes, perhaps, to get the to get the favorite. That 3 points is going to be the crucial factor in them being favorites.
Yeah, I think if you played either of those teams on a neutral field right now, if you made the Texans a favorite on a neutral field, I think the money would go hardcore to Steelers or the Chargers.
Now we're thinking like handicappers. So, yeah, on an even field, either of those. Yeah, so it ends up, Texans end up being like a 1.5 point favorite for either of those games.
That sounds about right. That's exactly what I was thinking, 1.5, 2 points for me on that one. Number one, power ranking of the power rankings, ESPN.com, which has been the most bullish on the Texans throughout their tumultuous last 8 weeks. They were 10th last week, even though they were 3-4 in their last seven games going into that Ravens game. So they fall four spots in the eyes of ESPN. This is DJ Bienname typing this. Biggest offseason contract to watch. It's a good category. Biggest offseason contract to watch. And DJ Bienname says Stephon Diggs. Says Diggs proved his value to the Texans on and off the field through the first 8 weeks with him. C.J. Stroud had a QBR of 60.5. That's 10th. But since Diggs tore his ACL, Stroud has a QBR of 40.4, 29th. Through week 17. So CJ has gone from a top 10. He was a top 10 quarterback with Diggs. He is in like rookie Bryce Young range without Diggs.
So with Diggs, it'll be interesting. He turns 32 this year. By this year, I mean 2025.
Yeah.
He turns 32. He's coming off of an ACL. I think the Texans would like to have him back. The reality of the situation is he's a 32-year-old coming off of an ACL injury. What does that contract look like? My fear would be that as much as Stephon Diggs was a model citizen while he was here, does he at some point feel disrespected by playing for whatever the Texans think is the fair price for Stephon Diggs? Sometimes it doesn't feel like disrespect in the moment, and then you get and all of a sudden you're playing really well. I guess that's the only thing I worry about. And if it's, I don't want to re-sign a 32-year-old wide receiver coming off of a ACL if it means you're turning down drafting a wide receiver or signing a younger free agent. So I'm open to whatever they do with it. I'm not hungry to get Stephon Diggs back on the team.
Yeah, I think something that should be pointed out without getting too cap nerdy about it is the Texans. We know that the Texans took Stephon Diggs' 4-year contract and took all the guaranteed money and basically just made it a 1-year deal, a 1-year $22 million deal for Diggs. They took about $16 million of that and crammed it into voidable years in the future. So there, if Stephon Diggs leaves, there is a credit card statement coming due for the Texans of several million dollars.
So for both parties, the Texans, it might be worth their while just like to maybe give a contract that's a bit more. If they can rework it into an extension, so they give them a contract, maybe that's a bit more than what others would pay, but it helps them out with the cap because they can spread it out more.
In the short term, So it's worth noting. I mean, I think ultimately the biggest thing with Diggs is how do they feel about the knee at that age,
You also get, now this is the thing, if you get a compensatory pick back potentially, I could see Diggs going to start ring chasing. So maybe he goes to a place where he actually plays a lot, gets a lot of production, and they end up getting a really good compensatory pick out of it.
Yeah, maybe so. Maybe so. Text message, Bobby Slowick, listening to Slowick speak at press conferences reminds me of a salesperson BSing their sales manager about their pipeline to avoid getting fired. I've made that comparison several times. When somebody's just up there just freestyling and just trying to survive till the next forecast is due,
The way it went, he gave an answer about what they looked, what they did during the bye week and what they were trying to identify, and one of it was identifying the strengths. On the next question, when asked, what are those strengths? He didn't have an answer at the ready. Now he also did say, okay, maybe I got to back up. He prefaced it by saying, I don't want to give you all the secrets or anything. But I don't know. I feel like that's like, okay, like any, if you're good at it, other teams are going to know you're good at it.
Yeah.
So that should be the question. What are you really worried that somehow other defensive coordinators haven't realized what you're good at doing?
Yeah.
I don't think that, like, what are defenses going into a game saying? What they're saying is we just got to take away Nico Collins as much as possible.
And
we feel pretty good. We're going to be able to stop the run. And it's as simple as that. Because Joe Mixon has done some really good things, but he's not a steady machine with this offensive line and with these tight ends blocking for him, and with the wide receivers aren't blocking the same way like the 49ers do when they're good. So, yeah, I think Nico Collins is the only answer.
Maybe the saddest thing for me about the Texans offense this year, for me personally, and I'm gauging kind of my reaction to things that happened this year, is that when Tank Dell went down with the injury, and this is before we knew the severity of the injury, this is when we're just like, okay, well, Tank, he's hurt, he's down. Is it my first football reaction? And obviously, my first personal reaction was, man, I hope he's okay. I love Tank Dell. My football reaction, you're processing, what does this mean now? What's this going to look like? My reaction was they weren't going to win with offense anyways in the postseason. You know what I mean?
Right.
Even with Tank Dell, this is an offense that had sunk to the bottom quarter of the league in offenses. So part of me is like, all right, well, I wasn't counting on more than 17 points in a playoff game even with Tank Dell. How much worse can it get?
The thing is, if they were going to make a run, it was going to have to be something clicking in the passing game. And the part where you just wonder what might have been was, all right, in that Chiefs game, it looked way more like you were hoping it was going to look all season long. And so the Tank Dell injury, I think almost symbolically but also substantively, taking that away, pulling the rug out when, man, maybe it looks like maybe something is clicking here.
Yeah, that's true.
That's, and then in that very game, you get into the fourth quarter and the better team handles the fourth quarter better than the Texans without Tank Dell do. So yep. Who knows? That's a most positive spin I could put on an otherwise miserable season.
Yeah. Yeah. A miserable season offensively. Yeah.
Yeah.
Absolutely. So, text message, three things CJ must fix in the offseason: pocket clock, escapability, accuracy. That's from Cyfair Frank also.
The thing is, too, that he's done somebody on my YouTube channel had said that CJ needs to learn how to extend plays better. And that's actually not an issue. He does pretty well on extended plays. Now, it's not a high success rate on those to begin with, so it doesn't always feel that way. But in terms of EPA on throws, attempts that are over 3.5 seconds long, it's Josh Allen, Lamar Jackson, Pat Mahomes, and CJ Stroud.
Yes.
CJ does a good job. The problem is the times I think he extends them too long at times, and that's where making the decision quicker to check down. He's gotten better as the season has gone along, taking the easy money, all of that stuff. It's not that he can't extend the plays. It's that he's a little too dependent on extending the plays. He needs to just take the easy money more often.
Yeah, man.
That was number one. What was number two and
number
three?
Number one, pocket clock. Two, escapability. Three, accuracy.
Yeah. So pocket clock is right, you're saying, number one. Escapability, I don't know how much you're going to do with that. I think the thing that I'm more concerned about his pocket movement, because I think last year as a rookie, he was really good as the season went along. It's starting to just, know when to take just a half step to get to clear yourself some room to throw. And it feels like he's regressed as he's gotten bludgeoned week after week after week.
Dude,
I don't know if he's got the same feel for it.
I think I was having a conversation with a buddy yesterday about CJ, and my conclusion I came to is I think those 3 weeks, Green Bay, Indy, Jets game on Halloween night, those 3 weeks where the pressure rate was so extreme. It was nearly 60% over the course of those three games, and he was getting hammered.
Yeah.
I think those three games damaged him. Not irreparably damaged him, but they 2024 damaged him.
And this is where it's all interrelated, and that's what's so frustrating about trying to figure this stuff out. Is that the types of pressure that he's getting, it's right up the gut. That Kyle Van Noy sack, it was, the protection was right. They had the numbers matched up.
Yep.
CJ expects to get protection, but it's right up the gut. And yeah, that's what screws your decision making the most. That Dalton Schultz, the easy opportunity to throw to Dalton Schultz, you look at that, man, Laremy Tunsil's getting blasted into the backfield on a power rush. And the rest of the pocket there was no place for pocket movement there. It was so compressed. He had no opportunity to take a sidestep to the right to clear room because all those guys were getting destroyed. And if there was a half yardage more space, So what CJ was waiting for was a route to clear downfield, and somebody was coming clear, but the pressure was right up in his lap. So, okay, yes, that should have been an easy throw to Dalton Schultz, but maybe only if he had gotten rid of the ball quicker. Mm-hmm. But why did he have to get rid of the ball quicker? Because Dalton Schultz got hung up in the backfield because Laremy Tunsil was getting destroyed, and the rest of the offensive line was getting destroyed as well.
Yep.
So it's just, it's all interrelated, and it's just all a big mess right now.
All right, Payne and Pendergast with you on a New Year's Eve Tuesday. Appreciate you guys hanging with us and tuning in. Up next, the three biggest takeaways from D'Amico Ryan's press conference yesterday. There are big questions heading into this Week 18 matchup with the Titans. D'Amico gave us answers. We'll have them for you coming up next.